good to be here. And I want to, again, thank Marty and thank Tara, the principal, as well, for opening up the school. I want to thank, I actually met with Mark Molinaro, who is the Dutchess County executive. We had a good conversation. He's not here today, but we met earlier today, and I want to acknowledge him. I know Dee Dee Baird as well, a wonderful elected official. I know that we have folks on the town board. I'm not sure if everybody's here that I'm going to name, but I want to acknowledge Rory Chase, Matt Zick, Don Bartles, and Sarah Jones, who are on the town board. I also want to acknowledge the Pine Plains Town Supervisor, Derek Cloud. Hi, Derek. I also want to acknowledge Mark Corellio. I hope I pronounced that correct. Just met Mark. Just walked up to me from Veteran Affairs. Fine fellow, and excited to work with you. Also want to acknowledge Dana Smith, the Commissioner of the Department of Emergency Response, as well. And I want to thank all of you for coming out this evening. We've been busy. I want to talk a little bit about the government shutdown and where we are now. And then talk a little bit about my priorities, what I perceive to be our priorities, now that we've gotten through this period, although it's not resolved totally. But I want to speak a bit about what I hope to get accomplished and what I already have been working on. And then I also want to speak a little bit about this and what this means, from town halls to accessibility in terms of offices across the district, making sure that you feel connected to me and to my team, and making sure you actually feel truly represented, irrespective of party affiliation. As your congressman, I have an obligation to serve everybody, and that is what I intend to do. Now, we got some good news today. The government was reopened. And mind you, I'm only going to talk for a little bit because I really want to answer your questions. So if you don't want, if you came here just to ask questions, don't worry, we're gonna get there. But the shutdown obviously had an incredible effect, a horrible effect on a lot of folks' lives. And I know that because I've met with a lot of individuals who were impacted. Whether it was farmers who were relying on reimbursements from grants that they got through the EDA or through the USDA, or whether it's the Coast Guard, who I met in Sarveys in Ulster County, who were sitting in freezing conditions, asked to cut ice so that we could have commerce up and down the Hudson River, and at the same time be told to not get paid. Whether it's small business owners who are looking for grants or applications, but they can't use those because the government is shut down, or SNAP recipients, who were hoping to access their benefits, but they couldn't because of the shutdown. This is the impact, not to mention the fact that the economy has contracted as a result due to these 35 days of a shutdown. So now we're here, and now we've gone to a place where the government is back open. To be clear, over those 35 days, here's what I did. I voted 11 times, 11 times to open the government. And each of those times to have back pay, 11 times. And the terms that I put forward and voted on were the terms that had been previously agreed to by the Republican-controlled Senate. So at every term, we voted on bills that were already previously agreed to on a bipartisan basis. Unfortunately, the bipartisanship stopped, and there was no ability to get beyond it because it became a debate around a campaign promise, and whether or not there was going to be any give at all on a campaign promise. And unfortunately, because of that dynamic, we couldn't get past that. And so people had to suffer. Now, I don't understand why you have to shut a government down to have that kind of conversation. I don't know why people have to suffer and worry about their next paycheck to have a real conversation about border security, which I can speak to and say I certainly think we need to work on border security. And I can talk about technology and personnel resources and all the things that are required for border security. We should be able to have that debate without putting us through what we just had to go through for 35 days. Shouldn't have to happen. And I voted to have the CBO release a daily report on the economic impact of the shutdown every day so that people would understand the impact and would spur economic action. I wrote letters to the Department of Ag addressing the SNAP issues. So I was active, and I, as some of you know, in solidarity with federal workers, did not accept any pay until the government was reopened. So these were things that I did on a personal level, and I did as a member of the party and as an American, to figure out how to move past this. So here we are now. These next 3 weeks, we have to really bear down and be cooperative and put the partisanship aside, put the games aside, and do the work. Listen to the experts, the facts, the evidence, and make an informed decision on how best to protect our borders. That's how we need to proceed. We're going to have hearings, public hearings. We should bring experts in and have a robust political debate without demagoguing each other. We can have a different point of view, but we need not make it personal and demagogue. And that's what I look forward to doing as your congressman. Now, hopefully we'll work this thing out. And if we do, healthcare, expanding the coverage, rural broadband, dealing with water contamination issues and water infrastructure, restoring our roads and rail and broadband, empowering economic development, dealing with the opioid epidemic, Lyme disease. These are the things that I have put on my team's plate and my plate to address. I just joined a bipartisan PFAS task force, which is meant to help deal with the emerging chemical that is PFAS that has wreaked havoc in counties right here in our own district, in upstate, in Rensselaer County, Hoosick Falls, and Petersburg. And we went toward the Lyme Caucus to do work around how we do R&D for Lyme disease research. That's critically important. This is the things that I want to focus on. I've met with the leadership, with the speaker, talking about rural broadband, how we need to bring rural broadband to upstate New York, particularly here at home. So these are the things that I have been focusing on and want to focus on relentlessly. The first bill that I introduced, a bipartisan bill that extends benefits to the spouses of service disabled veterans. I'm very proud of that bill, one, because, well, it's bipartisan. And I think it's important that we act deliberately, particularly as a new member, to demonstrate to you that I am committed to working across the aisle. I've also worked to pass the Blue Water legislation, which is also going to help those individuals who were exposed to Agent Orange during the Vietnam War while out on sea to get the coverage and the help and the care that they need. Another bipartisan bill. So doing the work on a bipartisan basis to demonstrate that I have a willingness to reach across the aisle is of utmost importance to me. Now, I can't control everything that happens in D.C. I wish I could. Right? I only have so much power as a lone freshman member of Congress. But what I have decided, and I told myself, is I can't control how I engage with you. That I can control. I can control the town halls, how many I do. I can control how many offices we have set up across the district. I can control how accessible I am on my website so you know where I'm going to be and when you can contact me. I can control the level of our casework and how attentive we are to detail and how thorough we are in the follow-up. I can control all those things, and I intend to. I want to be as great a constituent service congressperson as I possibly can be, and with the hopes that you find in me a real advocate, somebody that you can count on, irrespective of party, that you can come to our office, you can come to me and know that I will listen, I will engage, and then take what you give me, that information, with you to D.C. and be a genuine advocate on your behalf. That is the job. And I'm excited to be able to do that on your behalf. With that, I'm going to open it up. And just so you know, and I've done this now quite a few times, I'm not, there's no pre-screen questions here. I'm not going to be, just raise your hand. You know, I just ask that we're respectful to each other, that we're civil, and that we have a conversation. I look forward to answering your questions. So who's, there you go, right? Right there, I see you. What you speak of. Yes, I agree. I think what you speak of is the broken nature of our entire immigration system, right? It's the lack of any real clear regulatory framework that can result in our objectives, which is to make sure people can come here, work legally, and do so in an efficient fashion. We don't have enough of a systemic, agreed-upon mechanisms in place to ensure that. And part of that is making sure we have the means and the regulatory framework to hold individuals and companies accountable who are not abiding by a shared set of rules. So we have to get to a place first where we actually have a clear, shared set of rules that can act as deterrents for the kind of behavior you're talking about. But also can act in a way that gives clear lines of communication to the individuals who do want to come here and work legally. That's all a part of comprehensive immigration reform, which we can't even get to because we're talking about a wall. Now, to be honest, like, we're not talking about the comprehensive lay of the land here. And I met with farmers during the shutdown. And what they spoke about was the inefficiencies associated with the H-2A program and how there's been so much backlog even before the shutdown to access labor. But now with the shutdown and what it was causing, it was even more problematic. So it's not just overregulating or being overly bureaucratic. It's just having clear lines that account for the diversity of communities, that account for the diversity of needs, and then actually having the resources to implement them. And to make sure that those rules and laws are being followed. We don't have any of that right now because we can't just come to the table and have a robust public debate on the issue without demagoguing each other. That's the first step, is just get to a place where we can have a real conversation. Yes, sir.
I just love your intro, and I'm encouraged you want to be walking across the aisle. I have to say, though, that sounds like you're in the right direction, but I need to speak my mind on this issue. I'm sick and tired of all the lies and the double talk. And it's like, come on. All of our employees down there in Washington, D.C. understand that they think we're stupid. They're just so frustrating to me that we don't have real conversations with people. We have little sound bites. And, I mean, Schumer is an example. This is pretty easy to vote for the wall, and now he's talking about not voting for the wall. I mean, I just want to pull my hair out and stuff like that. I mean, 20 years we've been talking about this stupid wall. Build the stupid thing. You were talking about how you voted 11 times, but you haven't been specific about the wall. Are you for the wall? Or, that's clearly, in my opinion, a part of the deterrent process. And the idea that we're going to pull over this $500 billion is stupid to me on the size of our economy. You know, just build a stupid thing and move on. On the heels of the March for Life, I'd like to know where you stand on that issue as well. The science, you put down there, you didn't do it. Hopefully you listened to some of the talks. They were just talking very specifically about how the science is clearly on the side of pro-life, and I want to know where you stand.
couple things. I've been pretty clear on this. I don't think a wall is going to be the appropriate solution. Now, I want to be clear. That doesn't mean I don't believe in border security. It just means that I'm listening to what the experts said and what they're telling us in terms of what's needed for an effective deterrent. We have no operational control right now over the 2,000 miles of the border. A wall does not give us operational control. Operational control is when you can actually see all 2,000 miles at one time and monitor the activity and react quickly. Wall doesn't give us that. It doesn't do that.
Why not?
And it doesn't, why? Well, because the reason why a wall doesn't do it is because you're literally looking at one piece at a time. It's a physical structure that has no aerial point of view. So if you want to have an opportunity to see exactly, excuse me, sir?
People like and wait for you to answer.
Yeah, yeah.
So and I'm happy to call on you, but I'm done. Happy to. So the issue is, how do we actually act in a way, or use our resources in a way, that are most effective? And from my vantage point, and from the vantage point of individuals who actually have districts on the border of this country, Republican and Democrats, there's not a single member in my body, in the House, Republican or Democrat, who represents a border district who said a wall is the proper solution. Well, now they have proximity more than any of us. They're right there. And they're best positioned to understand what's necessary and what's not necessary. I believe, and this is a belief, this is not based in fact, but I do believe that much of the rhetoric around the wall is grounded in a desire to divide. It's divisive. It's divisive. And again, that doesn't mean that if you're for a wall, you are divisive. I'm just telling you that I think a lot of the narrative comes from that place. On the question of pro-life, I'm pro-choice. Doesn't mean that I don't, you know. As a personal matter, I'm gonna act and consult with my wife and my God, and that's a choice that everybody has to make on a very personal level. But as a state actor, as when you're thinking about how the state operates and what it can and cannot do, when it comes to a woman's body, I have taken the position that it is not appropriate to legislate what a woman can and cannot do with her body. I think we're good. Yes.
Johannes Sayre from Kingston, thank you for being here. Such a change from your predecessor. For what it's worth, Matt McHugh and Maurice Hinchey, I'm sure they would be happy to be working with you. So three really quick pieces of constituent feedback. One, the wall and the shutdown. Legislation needs to pass on its merits, not by coercion.
Yes.
Mr. Trump has held not only federal employees hostage, but services that we paid for, that our representatives voted to implement, right? So that's not how it works. That's not how we do business, and they will fail. Two, when you're considering climate change, the issue of how do we overcome the fluctuations in wind and solar is held up like a trump card. Oh, it's a failure. I have nuclear, I have gas. So storage is an issue. Battery technology is advancing. Battery technology is not useful in all circumstances. Please support the investigation of hydrogen production by electrolysis. It's clean burning. It doesn't produce CO2. If we burn garbage, if we burn natural gas, it will produce the CO2. It's a problem. Three, we here in the Hudson Valley, we have had the experience of having a large corporation here that used to employ 30,000 people, has dwindled to 7. I personally had the experience twice of being in departments where the mission was yanked out from under us and sent to a foreign country. First time they put us in a different division, the second time all the U.S. employees were let go. The employees from the group, the employees from the other country in the group were kept. So Corporations, U.S. corporations, need to be required to behave as stakeholders in their communities. The profit motive and deregulated markets fail in all kinds of ways, and corporations and American business needs to be responsible. So when you have the opportunity, please work towards creation of well-paying jobs that are built within those constraints.
So thank you. So let me take what you just said and try to respond to each piece, but in a cohesive way, because you talk about coercion and sort of the deteriorating effect that is ongoing when it comes to our democracy and civic engagement. I would argue that part of that has to do with the level of inequality in our society and the mass imbalance of corporate power as compared to people power, and how that has created this dynamic. It also informs the way in which we have discussions about protecting our environment and our inability to shift away from an industry that is outdated, the fossil fuel industry, to an industry that actually can create the kind of jobs that are sustainable, that are longer lasting, and that can protect our environment by investment in wind and solar, geothermal. These are all the areas that we could be investing in to not just protect our environment, but to actually create jobs. We have a lot of money we're throwing away through tax subsidies and tax credits to the fossil fuel industry. They don't need our help anymore. They're good. They make a lot of money on their own. We could take that money and invest it in our future. And I think that is critically important. And then that just ties right back to your last piece about the power of corporate America. And listen, I worked in the corporate space. I'm not anti-corporate. Right, I understand the role that business plays is their job, create jobs. That's how the economy works, in free enterprise. But you must counter that against a well-functioning, healthy, robust democracy. Democracy. Because if you just have capitalism without democracy, you end up in an oligarchy. You end up with just extreme wealth at the expense of the vast majority of everyday Americans. And that's how you end up in a situation where you have a healthcare crisis. Instead of expanding healthcare, you take it away from people because the people who were doing the taking don't care about that outcome. So it's important to put people in place who actually can relate and come from everyday experiences who want to help everyday Americans. And on that point, that's why I was pleased to support groundbreaking historical reform, H.R. 1, which was meant to actually empower small dollar donations and matching with matching dollars, restores the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, and requires states to draw their districts using independent commissions as opposed to allowing state legislatures who are just going to gerrymander the district and create the sort of extreme partisanship that we're experiencing because of that. So I'm with you. Yes.
Given the rhetoric and that we're constantly bombarded with, I think, especially living on the East Coast, very far from this, can you say, yes, we need better border security, we should do it in the right way, I agree, but what are we really protecting ourselves from, literally? What is your read on this?
That's a great question. So the question is, what is the perceived threat along the border? What is the issue? What is the challenge? I'm not even sure, and this is where, when you use language like wall, it can muddy the waters. Because it's not as if there's, at least from my vantage point, a threat that is the challenge. It's order. It's just order. It's understanding who and what is coming over our borders and how and for what purpose. We are a sovereign nation. We have borders. We have laws. We should understand the ongoings that are happening along our border. It's that simple. And the current lack of any concrete, comprehensive immigration system that accounts for everybody as they come to and from is a challenge. The fact that we still had, I believe last year, I think 400,000 attempts to illegally enter our country, 400,000, which is a big dip, 80,000. I think about 80% dip from 2000. So we're actually going in a good direction in terms of attempts at illegal immigration across the border, but 400,000 is still a big number, still big, and we need to figure out how to account for that. We have folks seeking asylum, and we have to understand what we need to make sure that that process is actually readily available and accessible and creates opportunities that we can track appropriately. That's important. And then there's the drugs. Now, we hear a lot of rhetoric about drugs coming over the borders, but that's not where they're coming over from. They're coming through our ports. Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure that we have the technology and the security, you know, to actually track that. I believe I heard somebody, I can't remember, I'm escaping the name, but there's an unbelievable stat where the folks who are monitoring the ports can identify about 80% of the stuff coming, but they can only track or actually seize 20% because they don't have the resources. So imagine, you can see it. You know it's there, you know it's coming, but you don't have the capacity to actually go seize it because of a lack of resources and a lack of funding and technology. That is the kind of security, that is the kind of enforcement, law enforcement that I think we should be pursuing. And we don't have to make it about culture. We don't have to make it about identity. Just make it about our security and make it about our well-being as a nation and our safety and the rule of law. I think if we do that and talk honestly about these things, we can get the ball going. Yes. Yes, I'm making my way. I'm making my way.
I'm just curious what Congress is going to do about the whole debacle with taking children away from people who are coming from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And the second part, from what I remember hearing and reading, that in some cases, they don't know where a lot of the kids are. In other words, the people processing that lost track of where the kids are. And is that true? And again, what is the new Congress going to do about that situation?
Well, the policy has stopped, right? The family-child separation, which was atrocious, right? That policy has stopped. But you're right that there are lingering impacts.
Yeah, I'm wondering where the children are.
You know, we need to, and this is again where the resources come into play, and making sure that we actually have a concerted effort with those resources to identify those children and where they are and to reunite them with their families. But that takes work, that takes resource, that takes actual commitment and not just lip service, right? So whether it's actual proper funding through the Department of Homeland Security for that very purpose, right? Or when people actually come through the borders in the asylum process, we actually have judges there, or we have resources there to actually make that process happen efficiently so that we're not put in this awful position of even having to entertain such a atrocious and immoral policy. So there's ways to do it, but it's all about the intentionality behind it and the resources. And I think legislatively, it's all about how you appropriate your funds, right? It's all about how you appropriate the money. Well, on this point, I mean, listen, I understand your concern. It's valid. I mean, part of our responsibility, particularly now that, you know, we've, as a Democrat, we now sit on a bunch of committees that can investigate these matters, right? From oversight, right? We can do the work now to investigate what's happening and how agencies are operating and what's been done or not done to reunite children with their parents, right? That's also part of our obligation. And I would hope that the chairs of the respective committees will pursue these ends. Now, I'd imagine that they will. I mean, this has already been discussed and talked about, so there will be oversight on these matters, and I think that's what it means to be a co-equal branch of government, so we intend to do that work. Yes?
Thank you for being here, first of all, and thank you for having a real town hall with a long
Thank you. Yes.
And I'm a little confused about universal health care as opposed to single payer health care.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm you proposed a universal health care plan when you were running, right? So I kind of understand both the two plans. I don't need an explanation of the two plans. I need you to tell me what's different in universal health care plan from single payer. And does it involve insurance companies? Does one involve insurance companies or one does not involve insurance companies?
I love this question. Yes.
And is one government run and is one run by insurance companies?
Yes. Great. No, I'm so happy. Those are I'm just sharing facts now. Not making judgments, it's just facts. 33 developed countries in the world. America's the only one without, listen to the words, it's pretty critical, some form of universal health care. Because not every developed country has a single payer system. And yet, they fall under the umbrella of what's deemed universal health care. Now, why is that? How can you still be a country that provides universal health care if it's not single payer? Well, what is single payer? Single payer is when the state runs the healthcare system, right? It's literally, there's no private insurance market whatsoever. Recent poll came out. If you tell folks that Medicare for All, or is about healthcare being a basic human right, about 80% of Americans say, sign me up. If you tell those same individuals that single payer is no private insurance at all, that drops that number to about 37%. So we do have to educate people on what universal healthcare is and what a single payer system is and what I'm advocating for, which is a public option, which is within the universal care umbrella, but not a single payer system. It preserves the private insurance marketplace. It creates that choice element, but it introduces a public competitor into the marketplace. And it says, here is the floor. Here's the baseline of care you have to provide. And that baseline is Medicare. In other words, make Medicare available to anybody who wants it. Now, to me, this is very achievable. One, because the choice piece is there. People like to, we are Americans, we like choice. I think it's important that we keep create that optionality. Not just from the standpoint of our desire to have choice, but in talking with individuals who have, you know, scenarios where their child might be, the need might be more nuanced, more sophisticated, that optionality is important to know that they can seek out whatever kind of care that they think is best for their child or themselves. However, we still need to be able to drive down the premiums and the deductibles. And right now, the current private insurance companies have a monopoly on the premiums and the deductibles. And that's why we're not universal. Unless you qualify for Medicare or you qualify for Medicaid, the only option for you is the private insurance marketplace. Hence, we are not universal. There's no universal way in which we all can just opt into something without being beholden to the profit motive. Medicare option does that. It'll drive down premiums, it'll drive down deductibles, and critically, it'll free up small business owners who are on the hook right now for providing health insurance, and it'll free up employees who feel like they have to be beholden to their employer because of their health insurance provided through their employer. And that creates economic opportunity seeking behavior, which creates growth in our economy from the ground up. So to me, there's a lot of advantages to a public option, which would ultimately get us to a place where we're no longer the only developed country in the world without some form of universal health care.
Follow up on the shutdown dynamic. Obviously, yes. You talked about the wall, and it's really a point of passionate difference. What are the elements of a reasonable, plausible, democratic proposal that you think could be negotiated with the Republican Senate and the President?
Well, I think first, as I alluded to, there are ways in which we can allocate funds for the purpose of border security. Whether it's funds that, based on our experts who've done the homework on this, that can go towards better technology to patrol, aerially speaking, the border. Whether it's fortifying areas, physical barriers that are already in place that we think need refortification. Whether it's making sure that personnel on the borders have the equipment that they need to best protect the border and do their job. There are key areas, and not just to get on the borders, but through our ports, that we can identify and appropriate funds for the purpose of maximizing addressing the need that has been made apparent. That takes the experts, that takes facts, that takes evidence. And I would hope that part of the hearings that we're about to have on this would get to that. That you bring people in from the Department of Homeland Security who spend their entire lives thinking about this issue, who research it, who understand it, who bring to bear an objective point of view on the matter, and then we can ask them questions. Well, what do you think would best be the appropriate way to protect the border? If you could do it, how much money do you think it's going to cost? And that's how you make informed decisions on such a critical matter. So we got 3 weeks. We got 3 weeks. Yes.
Well,
I live in Rhinebeck.
I'm going to ask you about the Peace Corps. I'm a return Peace Corps volunteer.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Need two parts. This is a. Do I need to repeat myself? Okay, I'm ex-Peace Corps from. And I served in Central America. I was a community guard and nutrition promoter. And I'm not sure why Peace Corps isn't talked about more in terms of some of these policy applications. Because we know, I was on the ground, I lived in a dirt floor hut. And I lived in with people and shared their lives with them. So a lot of Peace Corps volunteers would have. Insight into what to do in that particular part of the world. I've been there 40 or 45 times, and I think that would be something. I have some expertise, and a lot of other Peace Corps volunteers would have expertise that would be valuable to you guys in this. So I'm asking about, do you support Peace Corps? Or do you say, I hear nobody talking about it.
No, you raise an incredibly important point, Peace Corps and the values and how we project our principles to the world. And we spend a lot of time talking about military and physical force, and not enough time thinking about how we can live our values, our principles, our democratic principles, this idea that we actually believe that we're all equal and that we all should have an equal opportunity and that we care about the dignity of life and that we care about equality and freedom. And in some cases have to acknowledge that a lot of some of the hurt that is experienced in Central America, is a byproduct of some of our own actions, right? And how do we account for that? Right? How do we own that? How do we deal with that in a way that is consistent with our moral sensibilities? Moral. You don't hear a lot of people talking about morality a lot in politics. Maybe we should. Maybe we should talk about morality. Talk about love. Talk about compassion. Talk about empathy and mutual respect. And, this country is remarkable. We were founded on our principles. We weren't founded on tribalism or on identity. We were founded on this. We're very aspirational in this idea that we're chasing. And we've been chasing, and we've had ups and downs, but we've always been chasing. And it's important that we keep that in mind. And as we project who we are to the rest of the world and to ourselves, that should be the source of our power. our shared values, the sense of community that we have, irrespective of difference in diversity, right? We actually use our diversity as a strength, but it's bonded in our shared values, and that's what gives it incredible power. Because we could demonstrate to the world and ourselves that no matter where you come from and your culture, no matter your background, we all more or less want the same things. We all come from the same place. And we are an example. And so the Peace Corps does tremendous work in that vein because it's about that work. It's about extending ourselves beyond ourselves for the betterment of all. So thank you.
Yes. I'm a retiree, and in 2014, they passed the Smith-Kline Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act. Are you familiar with it?
I'm not.
Okay. What it does is it basically erases part of the ERISA Act from the early 1980s, the 70s and 80s. Where they can cut your pension once you retire. You go out on a pension thinking this is what I've got for life, and if the pension fund becomes in trouble, they cut your pension as a solution. Now, there's a bill in the House right now, H.R. 397. I would like you to look into it, and would you support protecting these pensions? Because we're talking about 1.5 million people nationwide, just 34,000 in upstate New York alone. The 707 in New York lost 70% of their pensions on their cut. How can you go from getting $36,000 a year for a pension to $12,000 a year?
No, listen, yes, I mean, I have to look in the HR, the number, what was it,
397.
We're going to look into that, but on that overall issue that you're talking about, yes, I'm with you on this. You know, this goes back to the question you asked earlier, the guy who was talking about corporate, right? About the corporations being stakeholders and not just thinking about shareholders.
Well, a lot of the corporations went bankrupt, and instead of paying off the unfunded liabilities into these pension funds, the chairman of the board and all that stuff took the big bonuses. They're gone, and the people are left holding the bag.
No, absolutely. And there's a culture of greed, right, that is sort of infecting how we go about the business of doing business. And it's affecting people like yourself and everybody else who should have to be, you know, comfortable relying on the fact that when you work and when you put yourself in and you invest in something, that you're going to get a return on that. You're not going to be left holding an empty bag, right, at the end of the process. So I'm with you 100% on that. I will look into the specific bill you're talking about. But whether it's pension, whether it's extending the life of Social Security and keeping it solvent, you know, whether it's making sure that we're properly funding our programs, that people have paid into, earned benefits over the life, these are things that are of utmost importance to me, and certainly want to do everything I can to preserve and to protect them.
Thank you.
Yep. Good.
I wanted to thank you for being here.
Thank you.
One of the things that happened...
You're listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. Representative Antonio Delgado's town hall meeting live from Pine Plain.
And so I'm wondering if we could consider the Electoral College before an election when it goes the way we don't want it to.
So I've thought about this, as I'm sure a lot of you have, and you know, the founders, they did a number of things, and I don't want to get too nerdy, but you know, I studied political theory, so I thought about this a lot. And the founders were thinking, in some respects, and not just Electoral College, but the fact that we have two senators for every state, right? The fact that there's built-in mechanisms in place to, in some respects, tamp down what has been called the tyranny of the majority, right? We have too much of the majority. And so what we've seen over, you know, time is how that is meant to create, in some respects, order. The challenge, though, is when you get to a place where, due to technology and due to accessibility and the information age, now we can really, so if you're a small state or if you're in a big state, you know, with social media, I mean, everything now, the world is flat, more or less, right? So information is flowing at a rate that is challenging what the founders were thinking of back then, and what they probably had no idea that they could happen, right? So that being said, though, I don't know. I can't commit right now to actually just throw away the Electoral College. It's a part of our system. It's been there since the beginning. And I think there are a lot of other things that we can do before we take that drastic a step. You know what we can do that can actually do a lot of good is just get money out of politics. That'll do a lot of good. You know what else we can do is make sure that we, like I said before, have congressional districts drawn by independent commissions so that they're not partisan, right? So there's just steps that we can do before such a drastic step that pretty much overturns, you know, hundreds of years of history before we get there. Yes.
Thank you for holding this town hall. I don't want to sound alarmist, but we're all in big trouble.
That sounds alarmist.
If the scientific fact of climate change produces the results that scientists expect within the next 30 to 40 years, most of the problems that we've discussed here and that you've committed to addressing will seem trivial by comparison. And I'd like to hear you say what it is that you, as a member of the House of Representatives, can do to help solve this emergency before it becomes existential.
Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like every week there's a new report, you know, that comes out from some either national or international body that speaks to your point. And the disappearing coral reefs, the rising sea tides, extreme weather events are unrelenting. And you're right that we are, you know, right on the doorstep here of an existential threat. I have committed, first of all, to making sure that we stop investing in the very industry that is causing the harm. Can't prevent the industry from happening, right? It is what it is. But we shouldn't be using tax dollars to actually prop up that industry when we know what it's doing. So we can stop that. And we spend billions of dollars in tax credits and tax subsidies propping up that industry. We don't have to. So that's a big, big thing. Now, I also have talked a lot about a carbon fee and dividend. I haven't decided that's something that I necessarily want to do, but it's the kind of idea that I think we should be entertaining, because we have to figure out how we deter the emissions. How do we bring down the emissions? And we have to have a robust conversation about the different ways to do that that are going to be helpful. Making sure that we actually protect the laws that are meant to protect our environment and fund the EPA and make sure that it has what it needs to do its job is critically important. The Clean Water Act, the Clean Water Rule, these are all very important pieces of legislation that are being undermined, actively undermined, that we have to protect. So these are all the different things that we should be pursuing. A select committee designed for the sole purpose of figuring out bold answers to this problem. And not just how we invest in renewable energy, but what kind of jobs and how we create the kind of jobs. Because I want to be clear about something. And I get the threat, and it's a big one. It's a big threat. But when you think about individuals, workers, people who have lived and made a living, you know, in the fossil fuel industry, when at a time, that was all we had. And no one was saying anything bad for a long time. And now we're talking about these bold transformational steps without also accounting for those individuals and making sure that we have jobs ready, a plan ready, investment ready to make sure that they don't feel just completely left behind and abandoned. So it's important that we do all of these things. And we have a concerted effort to doing all of these things. And we have to prioritize. And when we have these debates that we're having right now on matters that are more politicized than they are grounded in substance, we get taken away from the issue at hand. I want to come back over to, to this side. Yes?
We have a question from Facebook that I'd like you to answer.
All right.
Sorry.
Question from Facebook.
All right. Laura wants to know which, she's from a county in New York 19, which is described as economically depressed. What can you do about creating jobs for her area, Schoharie County?
Schoharie. All right. Well, how do we create jobs in economically depressed areas? That was the question. The big thing, and I didn't mention this earlier, I'm on three committees. Agriculture.
Yeah.
Yeah. transportation and infrastructure. And I just got added, you want to get to
WGXC is always looking for new programmers to volunteer at your community radio station. Email info at WGXC.org if you have all sorts of terrific music you want to share with your friends and neighbors.
Where the economic development opportunities are for New York 19. Whether it's the ag space, and it's our small family-owned farms, and the need to figure out how to provide support and help and opportunities for those kinds of farms, as opposed to the big mega corporate farms, none of whom you can find in our district. I could be an advocate for that work, whether it's making sure that we invest in our infrastructure, from roads to rail to broadband, access to quality cell service. And why is that so important? It's important because this is how you access the marketplace. If you are a business owner and you're trying to access the market and you are worried about your cell service, when you're worried about rural broadband, you're feeling disadvantaged, you're not going to put your dollars here. And you're not going to stay here. You're going to look for other opportunities to make money that allow you to access the marketplace. So that's a big deal. And then when you think about the fact that we're just, I don't know, what, 2.5 hours away from New York City, where there's literally about at least $1 billion of unmet demand for locally organically grown food, and we're the breadbasket. We could be the breadbasket. But we lack the infrastructure, the distribution plants, the processing plants, the marketing plants, the co-ops, all of these that we could be prioritizing with real advocacy on the Ag Committee for the kinds of programs like the food promotion program or the value add program. Or what we just saw in the recent farm bill, how we prop up and help our dairy farmers who are dealing with prices. We should be doing that work day in and day out. And to me, it's not one size fits all. There's no one answer. It's a collection of ideas. But the fundamental connecting piece is infrastructure. Whether it's water infrastructure, whether it's rail, whether it's roads, it's connecting all the dots and making sure that we can leverage our natural advantages. And it's also tying it into the renewable energy space. Because we also can be investing in that space that'll create jobs here at home as well. It's investing in workforce development training, so that they can take the jobs that are available to folks in the manufacturing space, the high-tech manufacturing space. So it's all different paths. And I think by sitting on the three committees that I talked about, I'll be able to pursue those different angles. And of course, fight for grants and opportunities for folks here at home. Yes?
I just want to make the point about government and how I think there may be one positive thing from the government shutdown. But I'm making a plea to you, the Democrats, your entire party, everything you're talking about, everything, the health insurance, everything you just talked about in terms of job creation, the making this the breadbasket for New York City, climate change legislation, health insurance, it's all government. It's engineer. I mean, I'm not saying I think it should be a socialist state. I think private enterprise has a huge role, but these things need to be steered and guided by government, by legislation. And this country has a terrible division right now. In half of it seems to me, who don't believe in government, don't understand the role of government. And I think the shutdown is a perfect opportunity. So will you Democrats not hesitate to say, look what happened when the government got shut down. Look at the services that are provided by the government. And sort of, this is a large issue, I think, philosophically in this country.
Absolutely. Well said. Well said. I'll say this. You are so right that you have identified what's at stake. And I wouldn't just say government. I would say democracy. You're right, government, because government can take many forms, right? We can call anything government, right? But it's really about democracy, which is the best form of government. And it's about empowering people. It's about giving people access. And where the government is, in fact, the will, it reflects the will of the people. Now, when you have, there are, and I believe this, that I believe there is a movement afoot by certain individuals or groups in our society who don't necessarily benefit from democracy, right? Who like power, who like money, who don't really care about whether or not, you know, people are affected by inequality. That's just the reality. And it's the role of democracy to course correct that human instinct, that self-interested component. There's a great quote that says, you know, our capacity for justice is what makes democracy possible, our capacity, but it's our inclination towards injustice that makes democracy necessary. Yeah. It's our inclination towards injustice. And so we have to institutionalize democracy and empower people. And that's where the role of good government, smart, thoughtful government, where the people are empowered, can play a role to course correct what are oftentimes just natural, you know, tendencies of human behavior, which is to think of yourself and to tend towards greed or self-interest. And so there's you're right to point out that there's this piece to government that was laid bare in terms of how it operates and how it connects us all and how it can really have an effect on everyday life that I think we have to make sure we highlight. And we shouldn't run away from as Democrats, I believe, or as Americans, you know, from the role of democracy and the role, how critical it plays, not just for here at home, but for abroad. Why do you think so many folks want to come to this country? Because of democracy, because they believe that they can get a fair shake here, that they believe that their race, their religion, their class, their sexual orientation, none of that will impede their ability to pursue whatever makes them happy. That's America, and that's the beauty of it. And so without a democratic government, we're not America anymore, right? And the argument can be made, a compelling argument can be made, that right now we're trending away from democracy. We're trending away from thinking about the collective, thinking about the will of everybody. And a handful of people and a handful of special interests are dictating the entire national discourse at our expense. And that's why we gotta get money out of politics. And that's why we gotta make it easy for folks to vote and register to vote. And that's how we gotta reintroduce civics into our classrooms and make sure that our young people understand the power of the vote, the right to vote. And if we build from the ground up and empower people, then we have a country that looks like us and reflects our interests. Now that's what I hear you loud and clear.
Hi, this is Mark Ruffalo, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre. Don't let the frackin' frackers frack you, bro.
Yes, yes, sir. Great question. Amen. You raise a good point. You know, when our founding fathers were thinking about the concept of service and, you know, public servant, right? That the concept was that, you know, anybody could run. You know, you might be a doctor, you might be a lawyer, you might be a preacher, whatever. You know, you decide you want to engage, you do so for a little while, and then you return back to what you were doing before you started to serve, right? In that capacity. It has become a career, right? It's become a way to you know, fatten your pockets, right? It's not about serving, it's about status. It's about projecting a certain level of power that's not about using that power for the benefit of the community you serve, just using it for your own personal gain. So on that point, I've talked about term limits. Now here's my issue, my frustration. I get 2 years, okay? And I'm gonna speak to you real. I get 2 years. I get in office, I'm already in office, right? And immediately, there's this systemic reality that requires you to think about, oh my goodness, 2 years out, are we gonna have the money to make sure that we can compete? And you have all this time to think about how you're gonna stay in office. You got 2 years to do it. And you gotta figure out who's gonna come for you, how much money they're gonna spend on you on TV to lie about you. And so it's a complicated thing. And you feel the pressure of that. And so I'm all for some term limits, but can I get a little bit of more time during my term? Can I get 3 years? Can I get maybe 4 years? Because then I have some time to actually do the work.
But not 30 something.
Not 30 something. Yeah, I would. I think.
What about with the Congress on the same health
care and nursing? That's a fact. That actually is happening. So on that point,
so they can retire, but they don't collect until 62, 65, or 67, their prorated rate that we did. Well, what's wrong with that? These guys get to, like Ryan. Ryan was about their pension. 48 years old, he's going to collect it off the bat. Is that fair to the American people?
Absolutely not. I'm with you, man. I'm with you on this, 100%. And just to drive it back home to what just happened with the shutdown. There's a legislation that's making its way through, or I'm not sure if it's been introduced yet, but I'm all over it. And it's called the Stupidity Act. I can't tell you what the acronym is, stands for something, but basically the concept of it is, we're not gonna end up in this situation again with the shutdown where people who get messed up are the people who weren't responsible for the mess up. So for instance, the next time we have to figure out appropriations and funding, if we can't agree in Congress with the executive branch, automatically fund from the previous levels and then withhold the pay of the executive branch and the legislative branch until we figure it out.
Yes.
Hi. Oh, yes.
How
you doing? I'm sad that you brought that up. Is Chief Volkman here?
Yeah.
Where? There you go. That's my guy. Peter Volkman, please stand up. Chief Chatham Police, he has started a program called Chatham Cares for You. An unbelievable, outside-the-box program. Where he said, you know, I'm going to open up our law enforcement. I'm going to open up our precinct. And we're going to invite individuals who are struggling from addiction to come to the precinct. And we'll guide you to the resources you need, to the bed you need, to the health, to the care that you need. Because he understands, like you have to at this point, that one, we're talking about a disease, right? Not a crime, we're talking about a disease. Addiction is a disease. And we're talking about the stigma that is associated with this in a way that no other addiction or no other sickness, because it's all sickness, is associated with. So we have young men and women who are struggling with owning it and dealing with it because of the fear of how it will be received by their families and by their community. So that has to change. And I think when you start having programs like Chatham Cares for You that decriminalizes the behavior, you begin to erode that stigmatization and you begin to empower people to seek the help that they need and do so in a way that is compassionate, that allows them to feel good about themselves. That's a very, very important piece to the puzzle. It's making sure we have funding for the drug treatment centers as opposed to funding for, you know, incarceration as treatment of choice. It's not a treatment. It's making sure that we are holding the pharmaceutical companies accountable for overprescribed. It's all these different pieces. Now, I am on the heroin task force. And I intend to do a lot of work as one of the leaders of this task force to figure out how I can highlight. You know, I haven't talked to you about this yet, Chief, but I intend to bring it to D.C. to hold hearings in front of the task force to talk about this issue and to figure out how to model it out in a more robust and aggressive way, both here at home and across the country. I also would note, though, that beyond the sickness that addiction can be, the disease, when you don't have economic opportunities, when you live in depressed, economically depressed areas, it only exacerbates the situation. And so it's vitally important that we do a lot of work here, and I do a lot of work here, creating opportunities for people and making sure that young people feel like there's hope here, that they can build their own family here, and that they can live here and have children and be happy. It's all part of, it's all connected at the end of the day. So that's the kind of work that I think, I know that I want to do and will do.
Congressman, we have one more question from the young lady over here, and then we're going to wrap it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, can we do a couple more questions? Right?
You can do a couple more, it's up to you. But...
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. I'm in eighth grade, and I go to public school. And with all these school shootings, how do you stand in gun control?
Yes, great question. First, I want to thank you for being here as a young person. It's very important. I also want to acknowledge the young women that I met earlier before the town hall who attend this high school and were kind enough to sit down with me and have a conversation. It's always exciting and very encouraging when young people are engaged and they understand their power. So thank you. Now, your power is important, and I think what we saw over the last 2 years on the issue of gun violence and gun safety is the power of young people in terms of the walkouts and how you force the adults to have a real conversation on this issue and put the politics aside. And we're getting there, and in fact, there's a bill coming, H.R. 8, that is going to seek universal background checks. Which, by the way, we've been talking about this since I was your age, okay? We talk about universal background checks for a long time. Now, that bill will have certain carve-outs in terms of, you know, gifts to your children, and carve-outs that actually help, you know, account for some of the rural communities. But fundamentally, it's a universal background check system that we don't have right now, that I will gladly support when it's put to the floor. That's a big step. There's a host of other things that we could be doing too, whether it's banning bump stocks, whether it's dealing with the issue of military weapons of war on our streets, whether it's making sure we actually fund the CDC to make sure that it's doing the work to study gun violence. And therefore we can figure out how to best deal with this epidemic, because it is one. It's one where we're seeing 14, 15, 16 year kids die a day, or at least be hospitalized. So it's a real issue that we have to get to the bottom of, and we take some real commitment. Now, I have not taken a cent, and it won't take a cent, and this goes back to money and politics, from the NRA. And it's not. I think something's wrong with you if you're a member of the NRA. Not even remotely the case. Because here's what I know. I know a lot of NRA members who are responsible gun owners. The problem is the lobby within the NRA, the board members of the NRA, who aren't really even thinking about the dues paying members. All they're thinking about are the gun manufacturers who put countless dollars into their coffers and say, don't you move on this issue, because if you do, congressperson, we're not gonna support you. So I don't wanna put myself in that position. And I think as long as we keep sending people to Congress and don't put themselves in that position, we can have a robust debate on this issue, an honest one, not beholden to outside special interest groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chris Cannon from the town of Northeast in Millerton. And just to bring this, first of all, I'm thrilled that you're here having a real town hall meeting and covering so many different things, from the cosmic to the existential to the local. And talking about the local, as a town board member, You talked about infrastructure, and you also talked about rural jobs. And there is a real connection, as you, I think, know, between infrastructure up here and jobs, because particularly in the area of water and wastewater.
Yes.
So many towns up here don't have even a sewer system.
Yep.
And a business tries to come in and open, and they're told, no, you can't do it. You have to build a huge commercial septic or something like that. It's a real, real issue. And it's such a connection between infrastructure and jobs.
Well, on this point, sir, there's subcommittees for each of your committees. And for the infrastructure committee, there's two that I'm on. One is highways, which is probably the most sought after subcommittee, because that's where the highway bill, which is gonna come out in the next couple of years, a big infrastructure bill, the big infrastructure bill. But the other one that I jumped all over was water resources and environment. Because I feel like from that position, I'll be able to actually focus on exactly what you're talking about, which is how do I advocate for meeting the needs of water infrastructure in our community? How do I fight for that grant funding? How do I fight for those resources in a way that can actually help here and create jobs and create, make sure clean water? And I think if we do that, you're right, it's a future that's sustainable here. And I feel like I put myself in the best position to be an advocate. So I'm gonna do two more questions, okay? Two more questions? I could be here all night, so my staff might not want to be. Yes. Yes,
hi. My name is Kevin Roque, I live in Stanfordville. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I want to get back to healthcare a little bit.
Yes.
It sounds like what you're talking about is returning to the Affordable Care Act and really some of the original ideas around it, whether it's a private marketplace, you have employer-provided insurance, you keep it. I think originally the Democrats wanted to have an option like you're talking about. Medicare for all option. I like that idea. I kind of think it makes sense. One thing President Obama said in talking about single payer, and he said he mentioned this to Bernie Sanders, is that we were starting from scratch. Yeah, he probably would prefer a single payer, but we're not starting from scratch. We have this $1 trillion healthcare industry and just throwing the disruption of, okay, everybody's now on single payer plans. You know, it's a big disruption in people's lives, which you addressed earlier. What do you see with some of the challenges with that, with people who currently have employer-provided insurance, but now there's a public option, so their employer goes, you go get that. And we're not gonna provide you insurance anymore. You're not gonna get a salary increase. And you still have to pay, if it's a public option, there's still gonna be a cost for that. That kind of issue, where people want to keep their employer-funded health insurance, but their employer goes, you know what, the government will pick it up, why should I do it?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. One, you're right to highlight the fact that it's a big overhaul. We're talking about a sixth of our economy, right, is the healthcare system. So it's big, and it's a lot of lives, a lot of jobs that'll be impacted by any real seismic shift or systemic shift. You raise a good point on the piece about employers. Competition, man. Competition. If you're an employer and you want to bring the best employees you can find, and you're in a marketplace and you're looking over at employer B, you're employer A, and employer B has the healthcare, has the optionality, you're undermining your chances of getting the kind of talent that you want. That's number one. So there is a competitive piece of this that free enterprise will, to some respect, take care of itself. The other hand is, well, if the options that the employer would have provided for the employee were such that they, in essence, were cost burdensome on the employee to begin with, and now the employer is saying, there's a better, more cost-effective option for you in the public marketplace. Well, and if you're an employee, you're thinking, great, thank you. Now I can pursue healthcare and not feel the burden that I'm currently felt through employer-based insurance. Because all employer-based insurance is doing is tapping into the private insurance marketplace. It's not like they have some special you know, place they can go to get, you know, they're going to the same marketplace. And it's gonna have an effect either way. And so by introducing the public option piece, what you're doing is creating this floor that in most cases will probably be appetizing, right? It'll be a desired outcome for a lot of people who are struggling with their current insanely high premiums and deductibles. Not to mention, I didn't bring this up before, it's a very important piece. We've got to make sure that Medicare can negotiate drug prices with Big Pharma. And that'll also drive down a lot of the costs. So I got one more question. Where is it? Right here?
Hi, my name is Joe Cavono. I'm 17 years old and I'm currently sitting in Milo. My question has really come from a partisan angle. I'm very political, but I don't really want to have a debate necessarily at this moment. I want to ask a question that really goes beyond just party line. It really speaks to the structure of our democracy. Recently, we've seen a lot of politicization of our judicial system. We've seen a lot more people wanting to put member of this party, what have you. I'm not going to play Republican or Democrat. There's plenty of more parties there that you could list, but for whatever reason, there's not enough votes. But we've been seeing this transition from where our Congress, where our legislative branch was designed to be the main body of our legislation, where most of our laws come in. And people seem, until about this year, we've started to see a lot of interest in midterm elections, but a lot of power seemed to shift. It went from the legislative branch to migration to the executive branch, and it shifted to the judicial. And it really hurts the way that our Congress is designed to work within the Constitution, I feel, where the direct input of the people through town halls like this, where we can directly engage with our representatives, is really undermined by the election every 4 years, and now it's shifting even to our judicial system. Do you have any ideas as to how you, as a representative, you know, of the people, can fire such young people like myself, or even your fellow colleagues within Congress, in order to kind of step up to the plate that was once mounted before them?
Well said. So, what you speak of, separation of powers, checks and balances, co-equal branches of government, and Article 1, number one, is the legislative branch, right? That's where we're coming from. That's the legislative body. It's where we make laws. That's where the laws happen that affect everybody. The job of the executive branch to execute the laws, and it's the job of the judicial branch to make sure that those laws are constitutional, that they are consistent with our principles and our laws, or in the amendments, Bill of Rights. That's it, that's the breakdown of it. But what's happened over time, and again, this goes back to the ways in which we've drawn districts, we have created so much partisanship by how we draw the districts that we don't incentivize commonality or cooperation. All elected officials are worried about, because of the partisanship, is being primary, having somebody in their own party run further left if they're a Democrat or further right if they're a Republican. And so we're literally running away from each other. So if that is the new paradigm that we're in, and you have cable news networks that feed into this, you have lazy journalism that is all about clickbait and sound bites, and you put all that into the mix, then you just have a chaos and noise and no sense of commonality or no shared purpose that's grounded in pursuit at an end that we all share. So what do you do if you're in that position, if you're in Congress? Well, you act out of fear. You don't want any part of that. And you don't want to step in. You don't want to do anything that's going to expose. So you start running away from your responsibilities. You stop doing what you're obligated to do under the Constitution. You start ceding that power to other branches, because you don't want that problem. You don't want to deal with it, right? And you see it happening in a host of different areas. You know, we can just start with how we engage the world, militarily speaking. There was a thing called the War Powers Act, but, you know, since 9/11, really the executive branch is pretty much able to do whatever it wants when it engages with the rest of the world. Well, We're the ones, we're the body that under the Constitution has that responsibility. That's our responsibility. Just take the shutdown that just happened. Just take the shutdown. Why is it that we have a Senate body, forget party, just Senate body, that is waiting to hear what the executive branch is gonna be okay with before it puts it to the floor? Why? What is it's a political branch. We do our job. Republicans, Democrats in that body, show up, do the work, put a bill to the floor, have a vote, then send it to the president and let him decide what he wants to do with it. Right? That is how it ought to work. But when you have a situation where people are so scared of how their reaction and their behavior is going to impact them back home because of they might get primary for not being partisan enough, then we run scared. And the body that I'm in right now becomes hollow at the core, hollowed out. No responsibilities, it's just empty. And we get inequities, we get unjust laws, we get everyday Americans left behind because we're not focusing on an agenda that is built on facts, that is built on being courageous, that is built on being a leader, that is built on our principles and our values, and that is built on thinking of others beyond yourself. And so I think a lot of what we've experienced in 2018 was a resurgence of that purpose. I think a lot of people who ran in 2018 saw that void and were determined to figure out how to fill it. And I can tell you, that's why I'm here. I'm here to figure out how to give voice back to this body, because this is the one body that represents the people, the will of the people legislatively. And that is the work that is required now more than ever. So I thank you for your question.
And you've been listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. That was Representative Antonio Delgado live in Pine Plains, his second actual town hall meeting, unlike the previous, there was only one meeting that Representative John Faso had, and it wasn't a traditional town hall meeting. It had special rules about how many people could attend and who could ask a question, and you had to sign up for this and had to be cleared by that. And this was the second town hall meeting Representative Delgado has had. Both this week. He had one on Monday in Rensselaer County, and then tonight in Dutchess County in Pine Plains. He's claiming to he's going to hold one town hall meeting in each of the counties he represents. I think it's 10 counties altogether in his first year in office. So we'll see if we can hold him to that, and we will keep broadcasting them live. The congressman's staff, our tax dollars are creating a Facebook Live video feed for each of these, and WGXC is picking up that video feed. So we're going to go back to programming.